Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Porter, and today we are taking a really exhaustive look at the future of science, as seen through the lens of, well, one of the most respected publications in the field.
And I'm Jamie Rufus. Our source material is the December 2025 issue of Scientific American, and I have to warn you, this deep dive is less about quiet breakthroughs and maybe a bit more about scientific warfare.
That's a good way to put it. We are announcing the title of this deep dive as Scientific American, December 2025.
Right.
And our mission here is comprehensive. This issue, it contains this stunning array of breakthroughs from customized medicine and deep space exploration all the way to planetary history. But all of it is framed by a single, pretty stark reality.
And that reality is the profound vulnerability of groundbreaking U.S. research to immediate politically driven funding cuts. So we're going to give you the comprehensive overview of the breakthroughs, the setbacks, and the unavoidable frustrating connections between them.
Let's start with that frustration then, because it really does set the tone for the entire magazine. The editor's letter, and according to our notes, it doesn't pull any punches at all. It uses a very painful visual analogy.
Oh, it's a perfect illustration of self-sabotage. The editor, David Ewald, describes this three-panel cartoon where you see a man happily riding a bicycle.
Okay.
Then in the second panel, he deliberately shoves a stick into his own front wheel spokes.
Ouch.
And then finally, he's just curled up on the pavement, injured. Ewald says this self-inflicted wound is pretty much the state of U.S. science funding today.
Wow. That analogy of just calculated self-harm, you can see it immediately in the turmoil that's reported in the health science sector. What are the specific actions highlighted as evidence of this funding fallout?
The focus is really on the actions taken by the Department of Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Right.
The magazine reports that back in June 2025, he fired all 17 members of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the ACIP.
All 17. The whole committee.
The entire committee. This is the expert panel responsible for determining the national standard for safe and effective vaccines.
So who did he replace them with?
They were replaced, and the magazine states this, with ideological allies, so individuals with known, pretty outspoken skepticism regarding vaccine safety.
So this isn't just a typical bureaucratic turnover. This is...
No, this is an intentional dismantling of a key public health advisory body. It's injecting ideology directly into the scientific standards of care.
That is a fundamental disruption. And it seems like the immediate financial damage, though, it hit the mRNA sector the hardest.
It did. In August, Secretary Kennedy announced the cancellation of roughly $500 million in federal funding.
And that money was for what, specifically?
It was dedicated specifically to developing new messenger RNA vaccines for various respiratory viruses. So, you know, going beyond just COVID. His reasoning was explicit. He claimed that mRNA technology poses more risks than benefits.
But that claim just runs directly contrary to years of research and, I mean, a massive amount of real-world data, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The data is overwhelmingly clear on this. Experts emphasize that the severe side effects of mRNA vaccines are just exceptionally rare. It's a minimal risk compared to the diseases they prevent.
Right.
The fact is, mRNA COVID vaccines saved millions of lives globally. Their massive deployment has demonstrated, you know, beyond any reasonable doubt, their exceptional safety and efficacy.
So this huge funding cancellation, it's fueled by claims that are, well, they're just not backed by the facts.
And it threatens to stunt not just updated COVID defenses, but the application of mRNA technology to a whole host of other critical diseases.
And that campaign against mRNA technology, it directly threatens one of the most exciting breakthroughs covered in this issue, a technology where those canceled funds were actually headed, personalized cancer vaccines.
Just, it's tragic to see a crucial technological platform threatened right at the moment it's yielding its most profound results.
Let's dive into that article, your personalized cancer vaccine. This is just, it's groundbreaking stuff. The core idea is creating an mRNA vaccine tailored specifically to an individual patient's unique tumor. How does that even work?
Well, the challenge of cancer is that it originates from the patient's own cells, right?
Right. So the immune system doesn't see it as foreign.
Exactly. It's hard for the immune system to distinguish the tumor as not self. So these personalized mRNA vaccines, they solve this by acting as a genetic instruction set.
Like a blueprint.
A blueprint, yeah. They contain the blueprints for these abnormal proteins, they're called neoantigens, that are unique to that patient's cancer. So when it's injected, these instructions teach the immune system's T cells exactly what those mutant proteins look like, and that prompts a massive targeted attack.
So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach like chemotherapy. It's a custom-built weapon. Mm. And the magazine features an extraordinary case study, Barbara Brigham. She's 4 years cancer-free after treatment for pancreatic cancer.
And that case study is so significant because pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma is, I mean, it's typically a death sentence. It's exceptionally aggressive. The 5-year survival rate is only around 8%.
That's incredibly low.
It is. Brigham was one of 16 patients in a phase 1 trial run by Memorial Sloan Kettering in partnership with BioNTech and Genentech.
And BioNTech, of course, is one of the pioneers of the whole mRNA platform we were just talking about.
Exactly. And 7 of those 16 patients, including Brigham, are still in remission years later. I mean, that suggests a tantalizing potential.
What's really encouraging, too, is that the initial research was for cancers like melanoma, right?
Right.
Which have lots of mutations.
Right. High mutation rates, which makes them easier for the immune system to spot. But pancreatic cancer has a low mutation rate. So the success here shows this technology has much broader applicability. We're talking over 20 cancer types currently involved in more than 50 active clinical trials globally.
The research behind identifying the right targets is fascinating to me. It's not just about going after the most famous cancer genes. They're using some pretty high-level computation to find the right fingerprint for the T cells to attack.
It requires some really advanced computational science and AI. Researchers like Benjamin Greenbaum and Dr. Balachandran use these tools to decipher which of the patient's neoantigens, the mutant proteins, are most likely to generate a successful long-term immune response.
And counterintuitively, they sometimes ignore the main driver mutations.
That's right. They often target what are called passenger mutations. These are the one-off anomalies that are unique to that specific tumor.
Instead of the common ones like KRAS.
Exactly. Because those common proteins don't seem to reliably elicit the required long-term key cell memory response that protects survivors. They're looking for the truly unique signature of that specific cancer.
And we really have to acknowledge how the COVID-19 pandemic just, it accelerated all of this. It was like the ultimate phase 3 trial for the safety and the scalability of the mRNA platform.
It was a huge unplanned boost. The work that produced the COVID vaccines, it built on 30 years of research that was originally intended for cancer.
So it's come full circle.
It really has. That confirmed the technology's safety, its flexibility, its core mechanism. Regulators now have a massive head start on understanding the platform and the ability to rapidly swap out the genetic constructions in the middle of the mRNA molecule, you know, leaving the cap, tail, and delivery mechanisms the same. It makes it incredibly adaptable.
But this kind of personalized medicine, it must create a massive logistical challenge. It's the complete inverse of mass production. Moderna went from making fewer than 100,000 doses pre-pandemic to over 1 billion in 18 months. How do you pivot that massive scale to creating these tiny, bespoke batches, microliters for one patient and do it in weeks?
You have to completely re-engineer the entire supply chain and the manufacturing floor. This shift from producing millions of doses and thousands of liters to these highly specialized patient-specific batches that have to be turned around so quickly, it's only possible through heavy investment in automation and AI.
What are they automating specifically?
Well, they're drastically reducing what they call operator touch time. They're using robotics to prepare sterile kits for each batch, which minimizes human error and any potential contamination. But the biggest hurdle is quality control.
Right.
A single dose of the vaccine requires 40 distinct quality control tests.
40.
40.
Yeah.
Chemistry, sterility, microbiology, everything. The sterility test alone used to take 2 weeks. Now, through refined techniques, they've compressed that to about 8 days, with the ultimate goal of getting it down to 5.
So the whole process, from sequencing the tumor to delivering the shot, has to fit into that tiny window.
And this reliance on AI algorithms to manage those complex logistics, tracking the chemistry and sterility of every single tiny vial, is just crucial to making this personalized approach scalable and hopefully affordable.
And this brings us right back to the political crisis. This critical, world-changing research is, it's endangered.
It is. The National Cancer Institute's funding, the NCI's funding, was cut by 31% in the first 3 months of 2025 alone.
That is a staggering reduction for what is the dominant funder of U.S. cancer research.
And beyond the cuts, the acting director of the NIH was asked to flag any grants or collaborations involving mRNA technology for the HHS secretary's personal review.
Wow.
So this creates an environment of turmoil, of uncertainty, and unprecedented scrutiny for researchers. The U.S., which pioneered this technology, is deliberately retreating.
And as the U.S. retreats, other nations are, well, capitalizing on the potential.
Exactly. The U.K., for instance, is moving forward aggressively. They're leveraging the pandemic head start, and they plan to roll out personalized vaccines to up to 10,000 cancer patients in the next 5 years.
So while U.S. researchers are facing hiring freezes and shrinking class sizes because of all this uncertainty,
other countries are moving rapidly to fully realize the potential the U.S. pioneered. It's that self-inflicted wound analogy playing out in real time.
A deeply, deeply frustrating situation. Let's shift our attention from groundbreaking endangered medicine to another massive U.S. science endeavor that's currently on the chopping block, the quest for Martian life.
Right. This is the Mars Sample Return, or MSR mission. The story, Stranded on Mars, details a scientific success story that is facing political and budgetary failure.
So the Perseverance rover's mission was pretty simple. Collect Martian rock and soil samples to search for evidence of past life. How successful has it been in that collection phase?
Oh, it has been remarkably successful. Perseverance was launched in 2020 and has now spent almost 5 years traversing the Martian surface, covering over 20 miles. It's focused primarily on Jezero Crater.
And that crater is a key target because scientists think it was once a lake, right? An ideal place to look for biosignatures.
Exactly. It's the prime spot.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of collection, the rover carries 43 cigar-sized tubes for storage. As of July 2025, it had filled 33 of these tubes.
What's in them?
So that includes 27 rock cores, 2 samples of Martian dirt or regolith, and 1 atmospheric sample. And 5 of the tubes are used as witness tubes just to make sure the rover's sampling system remains pristine.
And among those 33 samples, is there a specific one that scientists are just desperately hoping to analyze?
Oh, yeah. The Choava Falls sample is considered the crown jewel of the collection.
Why that one?
It contains iron-rich minerals. On Earth, the presence of these particular iron-rich minerals is typically evidence of microbes that used iron for their metabolism.
I see.
So planetary geologist Vicky Hamilton notes that if they could analyze this sample on Earth with full lab equipment, it could confirm if the same holds true on Mars.
Yeah.
It's widely regarded as the most interesting piece in the entire collection.
So if these samples actually make it back to Earth, what's the massive scientific payoff? What can we learn in a lab here that the rover can't tell us now?
The scientific value is just immense. It's a huge step beyond the remote analysis the rover can do. First, for life, they would analyze the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13.
Okay.
A strong, unnatural imbalance in that ratio is often a key sign of dead plant matter or biological processes here on Earth.
And they'd look for microfossils, I assume?
Microfossils, organic compounds, things that are impossible to confirm with the current instrumentation on Mars. I mean, it would be the first definitive evidence that life could arise somewhere else in the universe.
And it's not just about life, right? It's also about understanding how Mars became the barren planet it is today.
Correct. The samples act as a fossil record of the field. Electrons within the rocks should be oriented in the direction of the planet's ancient magnetic field at different points in time.
So you can read the history of the magnetic field in the rocks.
Exactly. Analyzing these electron orientations with X-ray scans here on Earth would reveal a timeline of activity within Mars's core. It would help confirm when its internal dynamo cooled, causing the magnetic field and the protective atmosphere to disappear. That knowledge is crucial for modeling habitability across the cosmos.
But despite all of this critical importance, the MSR mission is now, as the magazine says, stranded.
It's in crisis. The original retrieval plan was costly, estimated at about $6 billion, aiming for a 2030 return. But then an independent review in 2024 warned the cost could spiral to $11 billion and the date could slip all the way to 2040.
So NASA scrapped that plan.
They scrapped it to seek cheaper commercial alternatives. But the situation has only gotten worse since then.
How so?
Well, the latest blow is the Trump administration's proposed 2026 budget. It explicitly cancels the MSR mission, labeling it financially unstable.
And what's the alternative they're proposing?
They're championing an immediate shift to human missions to Mars instead. So the project's fate now rests entirely with the U.S. Congress.
That sounds like a political directive just completely overruling decades of scientific prioritization.
That's exactly the tone the magazine conveys. Planetary scientists have been pointing to MSR as the single highest priority for decades. And now, this politically motivated cancellation leaves 33 irreplaceable samples, the physical proof of everything we've learned. just sitting in the dust.
What's the hard deadline here? I mean, Perseverance can't run forever.
The rover has about 10 years of plutonium power left. Experts are clear. Construction for a retrieval mission has to begin within the next 2 years to have any chance of reaching the samples in time.
If the U.S. abandons the retrieval, what happens to those samples? They can last up to 50 years, so is it possible another nation could go and get them?
It's an uncomfortable possibility, but yes. If MSR is permanently scrubbed or postponed indefinitely, Perseverance might drop the tubes in a designated fail-safe location for a future mission.
A future human mission, maybe.
Maybe a human one, or potentially a non-U.S. mission.
A non-U.S. mission.
Former NASA chief scientist Jim Green raised the possibility. He noted there is, and I'm quoting, nothing on the tubes that says property of the United States.
Oh, wow.
And China, for example, is planning to launch its Tianwen-3 sample return mission in 2028, aiming to bring samples back by 2031.
So this could turn into an international science grab.
It could. While they are targeting a different location, the urgency created by the U.S. withdrawal could lead to some really unpredictable scenarios. The science community's frustration must be just immense.
I can't even imagine.
Planetary scientist Paul Burns summarized the despair, saying the science community cannot be any louder or more fervent about the need for this mission. If the samples are never analyzed, or if they're analyzed by a competing nation years from now, a critical chapter in U.S. space exploration will have been lost.
From the red planet and its frozen potential, let's transition much deeper into the solar system, to the icy moons of Saturn. If Mars is facing a political setback, the moon Enceladus is providing some new scientific excitement, and it's thanks to revisiting old data.
Right. Enceladus is a key astrobiological target. The Cassini mission confirmed back in 2005 that this small moon of Saturn harbors a massive subsurface liquid water ocean.
Okay.
So the prevailing view is that Enceladus has all three keystones of habitability, water, energy, and the necessary chemicals.
And the new discovery, detailed in fascinating plumes, it came from reanalyzing data that Cassini collected way back in 2008. What was the breakthrough?
So scientists reanalyzed data from Cassini's Cosmic Dust Analyzer, or CDA, and this was gathered during a 2008 flyby. They found complex organic molecules in the plumes that are shooting from the moon's south pole, which indicates a really rich chemistry happening in that subterranean ocean.
Why did it take 17 years to find this information and data that was collected so long ago?
The technical challenge was just massive. Cassini wasn't specifically designed to scrutinize Enceladus's chemistry. The CDA was primarily designed to analyze dust.
So it wasn't the right tool for the job.
Not really.
Yeah.
During the flybys, the plumes were overwhelmingly composed of water-like 98% of the material collected. And on top of that, because Cassini was traveling at nearly 18 kilometers per second, the impact shattered the organic molecules into these tiny, useless fragments.
So they had to act like forensic scientists piecing together these shattered chemical signatures.
Exactly. They focused on one specific flyby, E5, that was perfectly timed and used computational comparison to understand how different impact speeds affected the data. And this allowed them to confirm that the plumes contained suites of massive and complex compounds originating in the subsurface ocean, not just simple organics.
What specific compounds are we talking about?
They detected esters, ethers, and compounds that combine oxygen and nitrogen. Nazer Khawaja, who led the study, argues these are likely intermediates.
Intermediates, as in precursor chemicals.
Precisely. They are chemical stepping stones. Kevin Hand from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory calls this the tip of the iceberg, suggesting these intermediates could feed into a broader network of reactions.
And on Earth, these are the kinds of reactions that lead to what?
On Earth, these compounds are associated with the chemistry needed to create pyrimidines, which are necessary building blocks for DNA and lipids, which form the necessary barriers for cell membranes.
So if that network of biological precursor reactions is happening, that dramatically increases the chances of finding life in a future mission.
It absolutely bolsters the case for future dedicated probes.
Yeah.
But Khawaja brings us back that ultimate astrobiological conundrum, which is similar to the one facing the Mars samples.
Which is?
If future missions confirm all three keystones of habitability, the water, the energy, and these complex precursors, and yet they fail to find life, it would force us to conclude that life needs something more.
So we could have all the ingredients, but the recipe itself might be far rarer than we currently assume.
Exactly. It's a profound question to leave hanging over the scientific community.
It really is. Bringing our focus back to Earth and to human health, let's pivot from astrobiology to a major victory in understanding a debilitating illness. postpartum depression, or PPD.
Right. This article, The Mother of Depressions, it details a crucial shift in our understanding of PPD. Historically, it was often just dismissed as baby blues or simply lumped under major depression with peripartum onset in the DSM-5.
Which led to inadequate treatment, right? Just relying on traditional slow-acting SSRIs.
Exactly. And yet PPD is devastatingly common. The magazine calls it a leading cause of death among new mothers, affecting about 500,000 women yearly in the U.S.
And the duration of the symptoms is shocking. For some women, it can persist for up to 11 years.
The historical lumping was the problem? Because PPD is biologically distinct. The neurobiology is driven by a massive, specific hormonal event. During pregnancy, levels of progesterone and its related neurosteroid, allopregnanolone, they surge dramatically.
How dramatic?
Up to 100 times higher than normal. And the brain adapts to this flood.
But then what happens immediately after delivery?
The levels just crash precipitously. And for women who are particularly sensitive to this rapid withdrawal, it severely disrupts the brain circuits that are responsible for mood regulation, particularly the GABA receptors.
So this hormonal crash, this neurosteroid drop-off, is the biological trigger.
It's the trigger for PPD. And understanding that specific mechanism led directly to the development of the new drug, zuranolone.
Which was approved in 2023.
Right. It's a synthetic compound designed specifically to offset that neurosteroid crash, restoring balance to the brain's GABA circuits. And this is a massive advancement because it's an oral medication taken over just a two-week course.
And the previous treatment, brexanolone, was effective, but the logistical hurdles were just enormous.
They were prohibitive. Brexanolone required a 60-hour continuous hospital infusion, making it financially burdensome and emotionally taxing for a new mother. Zuranolone removes that huge access barrier.
And the speed of relief is revolutionary compared to traditional SSRIs, which can take weeks, even months, to show an effect.
The speed is the key differentiator, especially in acute high-risk cases. Patients like nurse Christina Leos, who had tried multiple SSRIs without success, reported that the huge cloud lifting occurred within 3 days of starting zuranolone.
That's incredible.
In clinical studies, about 60% of patients saw a meaningful, rapid reduction in symptoms. And the key is that the antidepressant effects are rapid and they're sustained even after the two-week course is completed.
So this sounds like a total game changer for women struggling with acute PPD. But what are the challenges that remain?
Well, cost is the primary challenge. It's $16,000 for the two-week course.
Wow.
While major commercial insurers and Medicaid often cover it, sometimes through manufacturer assistance programs, the high price is a barrier, especially since Medicaid covers about 40% of U.S. births.
And you mentioned only a 60% response rate.
Right, which suggests that PPD is not a single monolithic disease. It likely has different underlying mechanisms in different people.
Which leads directly to the future of the field, finding biomarkers. How are scientists moving beyond symptoms to identify risk before or immediately after delivery?
Well, this shift to viewing PPD as a biological disease is spurring the search for measurable biomarkers. One promising area is epigenetics, so changes in DNA methylation, specifically in two genes linked to estrogen sensitivity.
And these changes can predict risk.
It appears so. These changes appear to predict which women are most likely to develop PPD, which offers a way to screen and initiate early intervention.
And the other promising avenue involves those tiny cellular messengers.
Yes, extracellular vesicles, or EVs. These are tiny sacs released by cells that carry genetic material, including messenger RNA, throughout the body. Because some of this mRNA originates in the central nervous system, EVs offer a potential non-invasive window into the maternal brain.
So what did the EV analysis reveal about women who developed depression?
Researchers found that the EV mRNA content was extensively altered in these women. They particularly noted a dearth of mRNAs involved in autophagy, the cell's waste removal system.
Which is a known feature in other diseases, right?
Yes, autophagy disruption is a known feature in neurodegenerative diseases. So this finding gives scientists a quantifiable biological clue that could lead to feasible EV-based blood tests within the next decade, ultimately helping to destigmatize the illness and ensure women receive rapid, targeted treatment.
A truly crucial area of progress. Now let's transition from medical advancements to the delightful and surprising findings that are summarized in the advances section, starting with some genuinely smart dogs.
We're looking at animal behavior and this concept of gifted word learner dogs, primarily border collies, and their ability to categorize objects by function, not just appearance.
The focus is on Aria, a 6-year-old border collie in Italy. And the study taught these exceptional dogs words for objects based solely on what the object does.
Right. So they were taught words like pulls for tug toys and throws for fetch toys. And they deliberately ensured the toys were all different sizes, shapes, and colors to prevent the dogs from using visual appearance as the primary cue.
And the cognitive flexibility they demonstrated was striking.
After 4 weeks, when they were presented with brand new, never-before-seen toys, the dogs were asked to fetch a pull or a throw. And they chose the right toy 2/3 of the time.
Which showed they could extend a familiar word to a new object based purely on its function.
Exactly. It's a cognitive leap previously observed only in human children around 14 months old.
Ornithologists note that human infants rely mostly on appearance until about that age. Then they start using function and context. This offers a unique parallel.
The study's value is that it was a clean way to probe how categories might form across species. You know, isolating function away from all other sensory cues. It suggests a shared cognitive pathway for categorization.
Speaking of surprising patterns, let's jump from animal behavior to oceanography and the study of rogue waves. After that 84-foot Doppler wave proved they were terrifyingly real in 1995, the goal has been to understand the mechanism.
Right, they were long considered maritime folklore, but the Doppler wave provided the first solid proof. So this new study analyzed over 27,500 North Sea wave measurements recorded over 18 years. And it confirmed the physical mechanism behind these lone giants.
What is the mechanism that creates these walls of water?
They're caused by multiple wave trains. So sets of waves traveling across the ocean, intersecting and reinforcing one another through constructive interference. This amplification causes one specific wave's height to spike dramatically compared to its neighbors.
And the most crucial finding is the ability to forecast them.
Yes. The researchers found that this convergence creates a distinct, repeating interference pattern, a visible fingerprint that precedes the rogue wave.
So you can see it coming.
You can. Detecting the signature could transform these unpredictable terrors into forecastable hazards, giving advanced notice up to a minute before the wave strikes. This is a game changer for shipping and offshore infrastructure safety.
A massive step in applied physics. Now let's switch gears completely to archaeology, where bearded vultures in southern Spain are acting as accidental long-term curators.
The bearded vulture, or Quebranta huesos, is famous for dropping bones to break them. But their other habit is nesting on these remote, dry cliff faces. Their reusable nesting caves are perfect low-humidity time capsules.
Wait, so the vultures are collecting human artifacts and storing them?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
Researchers are rappelling into these inaccessible sites and finding that the vultures' habits have preserved history spanning over 600 years.
What have they found?
A crossbow bolt, part of a slingshot, and a peculiar piece of leather that might be a mask. They are particularly fond of shoes. Excavating the upper layers of just 12 sites yielded 25 shoes woven from esparto grass.
25 shoes from the 13th century, preserved by a bird. That's better curation than many museums.
The preservation is incredible, and archaeologists believe the deeper layers could hold artifacts dating back 29,000 years, a period when these vultures lived alongside human hunter-gatherers in the Iberian Peninsula. It's a truly unique, aviary-maintained window into deep human history.
Let's stay with surprising phenomena, specifically solving the centuries-old mystery of will-o'-the-wisps, those spooky, faint blue lights hovering over bogs and marshes.
Right. Historically, they were attributed to ghosts or spirits, and we knew the scientific answer involved methane from decaying marsh material igniting. But the puzzle was, what was the ignition source? I mean, the phenomenon occurs at ambient temperatures.
And the new study solved it using the concept of microlightning.
That's the key. The ignition source is microlightning, tiny, spontaneous sparks of electricity. These sparks occur when methane bubbles burst at the surface of the water.
How does that create a spark?
As they burst, they form micro droplets of water, which spontaneously pick up opposite electric charges. When oppositely charged micro droplets get close to each other, an electric current rushes between them, creating a microscopic spark powerful enough to ignite the methane and create that ghostly luminescence.
And the implication of this phenomenon is much larger than just spooky lights.
Richard Czar, the senior author, highlights the broader implication for prebiotic chemistry. His team previously found that this kind of microlightning can drive chemical reactions in the surrounding air to form simple organic molecules.
So it could be a mechanism for the origin of life.
It's a possible one. This same spontaneous electrical energy, generated by bursting microdroplets, might have been a critical, ubiquitous mechanism that helped generate the chemical building blocks necessary for early life on Earth billions of years ago.
Before we move on, there was a tiny mathematical curiosity mentioned, the slicing problem. It speaks to the concept of Prince Rupert's property.
Yes. Prince Rupert's property refers to whether a geometric shape, specifically a convex polyhedron, can pass through a hole cut in a congruent, identical copy of itself.
Like the famous Prince Rupert's cube.
Exactly. A cube that can pass through a slightly smaller square hole cut in an identical cube. The new discovery is the nonpropithedron.
And what's special about it?
It's the first proven convex polyhedron that lacks Prince Rupert's property. Mathematicians designed this specific shape and then used computer modeling and rigorous mathematical reasoning to confirm that, unlike the cube, it is fundamentally constrained and cannot pass through a hole cut in an identical copy. It provides a definitive counterexample to the question of whether all convex polyhedra possess this surprising property.
A fascinating abstract constraint solved. Let's shift gears now and look at two planetary scale problems that are intrinsically linked: the economy driving plastic pollution and the deep history of CO2. Let's start with the economic imperative driving the oil and gas industry's pivot to plastic.
This is a story of corporate survival that's being driven by climate change.
Mm-hmm.
As demand for fuel declines because of the rise of electric vehicles and global climate commitments, the oil and gas industry is betting heavily on petrochemicals, specifically plastic, to protect its future profitability.
How massive is this financial commitment?
It's staggering. Saudi Aramco plans to nearly triple its crude to petrochemical conversion by the 2030s. ExxonMobil, which is already the world's largest producer of single-use plastics, plans to increase its petrochemical production by 80% by 2050.
So they're switching from burning oil to bottling it.
That's a great way to put it.
Right.
The industry anticipates that petrochemicals, with plastics comprising 80% of that sector, will drive nearly half of oil demand growth by mid-century.
And we are already just drowning in the environmental consequences. What are the sheer numbers that quantify this plastic waste crisis?
The numbers are overwhelming. Since 1950, over 10 billion metric tons of plastic have been produced. Annual output has skyrocketed from 2 million metric tons to over 500 million today.
And the waste management is just...
It's a huge crisis. 79% of all plastic ends up in landfills or the natural environment. Only about 9% is recycled globally, and in the U.S., the rate is as low as 5 to 6%. And critically, half of all plastic is produced for single-use items.
And the cost of this pivot extends far beyond just unsightly waste. The magazine clearly articulates the profound health implications of microplastics.
This is perhaps the most shocking insight. Microplastics are no longer just an external pollutant. They are now fundamentally integrated into human biology.
Where have they been found?
They have been found in human blood, semen, breast milk, bone marrow, placentas, kidneys, livers, and even the brain.
That suggests it's a systemic biological threat.
It really does. One study cited in the magazine linked microplastics found in neck artery plaque to a 4.5 times higher risk of stroke or death 3 years later. And the production itself releases greenhouse gases comparable to the total emissions of an entire industrialized nation like the UK.
The magazine also highlights the environmental justice disaster playing out in the US, specifically in Cancer Alley.
This is a critical example of policy failure and environmental racism. This 137-kilometer stretch of the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and New Orleans contains about 150 refineries and petrochemical plants.
And they are deliberately located where?
Often beside low-income communities of color, like St. James Parish, churning out massive levels of carcinogens like ethylene oxide. Research from Tulane Law School has linked the concentration of toxic pollution in these predominantly black neighborhoods to significantly higher cancer rates, validating decades of community concern.
And the industry strategy seems focused on shifting responsibility away from production caps by advocating for recycling and waste management.
It's classic greenwashing. Industry lobbies aggressively against production caps, arguing for better recycling, even though recycling is economically uncompetitive against cheap, abundant virgin plastic. The U.S., which produces more plastic waste than any other nation, still exports about 400,000 metric tons annually, primarily to Southeast Asia.
Where that waste often ends up being burned, creating a whole new layer of pollution.
Exactly. Since China's 2018 ban, this waste has deluged nations like Indonesia. In Tripoto, exported plastic is now burned as cheap fuel in small-scale tofu factories.
And that releases what?
Highly toxic dioxins and furans contaminating the local food supply. Chicken eggs in Tripoto, for example, contain toxic forever chemicals and the second highest dioxin level ever detected in an egg across all of Asia.
And this lobbying power culminated in a policy failure at the UN level.
The UN Global Plastic Pollution Treaty negotiations collapsed in August 2025. Over 70 nations pushed for production caps, but they were thwarted by industry opposition and major producers, including the U.S. under the Trump administration, which reversed course to oppose life cycle language and favor recycling over mandating reduction.
So what's the conclusion?
Experts like industrial ecologist Roland Geyer conclude that without strong laws mandating reduction, the only way to manage the impacts is to make and use less of it.
This discussion of carbon and large-scale atmospheric chemistry leads us naturally to the magazine's Q&A with Peter Brannon, offering a new view of CO2. He argues we shouldn't just see CO2 as a villain, but as a fundamental character in planetary history.
Brannon's thesis is that CO2 is the most important molecule for life on Earth. It's the source of all carbon-based life, and it's the planet's thermostat. It's a necessary component.
And he uses the snowball Earth counterpoint?
Right. If we magically removed all CO2, the planet would plunge into a rapid snowball Earth scenario, freezing the ocean solid.
That frames our current crisis in geological time. He uses a fantastic analogy to explain the massive scale of fossil fuel use, the geological battery.
He explains that the air we breathe, which is over 20% oxygen, exists only because carbon has been buried in the crust for hundreds of millions of years, forming fossil fuels. This burial allowed oxygen levels to rise and remain stable.
So it's like a battery.
A huge planetary battery, with oxygen stored on the surface and reduced organic carbon stored underground.
And humanity, then, is the creature discharging that battery at an unbelievable rate.
We are the fire creature extracting energy by reuniting the two reservoirs, the carbon underground and the oxygen in the atmosphere, through burning fossil fuels. This process is the almost instantaneous discharge of energy that took all of Earth's history to build up.
He also addresses the climate counter-argument that current CO2 levels are still lower than they were during the Eocene, 50 million years ago, when the planet was thriving.
He stresses that this argument is dangerously short-sighted because it ignores the variable of time. For the past few million years, global civilization has adapted entirely to a low CO2 ice house world with stable polar ice caps.
And to reverse that in a century is just too fast.
It's a massive shock. Our current global civilization, with 8 billion people, complex logistics, and geographically specific agriculture, cannot withstand that rapid, chaotic reversal. He finds it eerie, even alarming, how human industrial civilization is mimicking the kind of biogeochemical events that caused the biggest mass extinctions in Earth's history.
Does he express any guarded optimism about our way forward?
He does, yes. He points to the amazing progress in solar power, which is becoming astonishingly cheap and beginning to outcompete fossil fuels purely on price and technology.
Technology could save us.
It provides a path forward, provided we can implement it politically and logistically. But his optimism is tempered by the new massive energy demands of the current technology boom, specifically AI.
Right, the data centers, the computation.
He is highly skeptical about it. AI companies are running headlong into hard constraints involving physics and economics. He notes they seem to hand wave away the massive energy generation required, often the equivalent of building new nuclear reactors, at a time when the U.S. can barely manage its current electrical grid. He anticipates that the current AI boom will eventually run into a massive adjustment where energy demands just outpace reality.
That sets us up perfectly to transition into the ethical challenges of that rising technology, specifically the article covering AI grief bots and deepfake law. Let's start with mourning becomes electric and the rise of digital ghosts.
These are generative AI creations, grief bots or dead bots, created from large language models to simulate a deceased loved one by analyzing their text messages, emails, or journals, allowing the user to converse with them in their style. The author recounts his experience conversing with his own dad bot.
And this is completely different from prior death tech. These AIs can generate new, contextually relevant material in the loved one's voice.
They are far more lifelike and interactive. We've seen examples from the author's experience to Laurie Anderson's Lou Reed bot. The AI's ability to predict speech patterns allows it to mimic the personality and conversational style of the deceased.
Is there genuine therapeutic potential here, or is this just capitalizing on deep sadness?
Well, therapists like Robert Niemeyer see potential. He points out that society often struggles with open, protracted grief.
Right.
The AI ghost provides a non-judgmental, pressure-free space for interaction. Niemeyer sometimes asks patients to imagine a lost loved one fully healed. The AI offers a more immersive version of this, allowing mourners to work through feelings without social constraints.
And the user experience seems largely positive as long as they understand it's a simulation.
Studies suggest mourners largely found the AIs beneficial, feeling less burdened and more capable of socializing afterward. The crucial point is that users generally understood they were engaging in a fictional or role-playing mode. They knew it's not really mom.
But the risks, particularly concerning the natural grieving process, are significant.
Clinical psychologist Mary Frances O'Connor warns that grief requires the brain to eventually accept that the person is gone forever. This process involves the brain shifting the memory of the person from evoking pain to bringing solace, and that usually takes about 2 years.
And a chatbot could disrupt that.
It could. A highly lifelike, interactive chatbot risks disrupting this essential process by making the past too attractive to let go. The technology is especially risky for people struggling with certain mental states or social isolation.
And this same core technology enables deepfakes, which the magazine argues is not just a technology problem, but a severe social order problem.
The editorial copyright laws can stop deepfakes, argues that a society that doesn't know what is real cannot self-govern. Generative AI can counterfeit reality at an industrial scale, threatening democracy, finance like the $25 million corporate impersonation fraud, and most profoundly, individuals.
And the primary victims of non-consensual deepfakes are overwhelmingly women and girls.
Absolutely. The problem is immense and growing rapidly. Research indicates that 96% of non-consensual deepfakes are intimate images, and 99% of those depict women. Disturbingly, incidents of AI-generated child sexual abuse videos increased 400% in the first half of 2025 alone.
And the current laws just aren't sufficient to handle this scale of abuse. What policy solution does the magazine advocate for to combat this industrial-scale victimhood?
They advocate for a U.S. federal law that mirrors Denmark's recent proposal, giving people copyright rights to their own face and voice.
Why copyright specifically? Why wouldn't privacy laws work here?
Because of platform behavior. A 2024 study reported a batch of new deepfakes to the platform X, splitting the complaints between privacy violations and copyright infringements.
And what happened?
X quickly removed the copyright claims, but none of the privacy violations. Copyright infringement complaints trigger fast, automated action from platforms. Privacy violations are often bogged down or ignored. A federal right-to-likeness law, enforced through copyright mechanisms, would provide fast removal rights and allow victims to sue for meaningful damages, enforcing a baseline of accountability that current laws fail to deliver.
From the ethical misuse of AI to the controversial use of genetics in embryo selection, let's discuss the ethics outcry over genetic optimization detailed in the forum section.
This covers the June 2025 launch of Nucleus Genomics' Nucleus Embryo Service, which offered genetic optimization for complex, desirable traits like intelligence, longevity, reduced risk of heart disease, and even things like acne.
For thousands of dollars per embryo.
Right. And the immediate, predictable reaction from critics was designer babies and fears of eugenics, evoking the dystopian film Gattaca.
That was the knee-jerk headline reaction. But bioethicists Arthur Kaplan and James Terbury argue that the analogy isn't Gattaca, it's The Dropout, a reference to the Theranos scandal.
So they're saying it's a scam. Not necessarily intentional fraud like Theranos, but the company is leveraging reliable technology to make fantastical, unsupported claims.
What's the legitimate, reliable technology they're building upon?
Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD, which has been used reliably for decades in IVF. PGD successfully detects single-gene hereditary diseases like Huntington's and Tay-Sachs, or major chromosomal abnormalities. That is established, trustworthy science.
So where does the deception or the flaw enter the picture when they talk about optimizing for intelligence?
Nucleus Embryo expands PGD to include those highly complex multifactorial traits like IQ, longevity, and body mass index using polygenic risk scores, PRS.
And that's where the problem is.
That is the central damning flaw. PRSs, while useful for academic research, are currently of highly dubious clinical value for prediction.
And why is their predictive value so limited?
First, they're largely derived from studies of Western European ancestry, which limits their predictive power globally. More critically, even for those of European ancestry, their predictive power for complex traits is so weak and limited that they are not used as standard clinical care anywhere in the world.
Because traits like intelligence involve hundreds, maybe thousands, of genes interacting with countless environmental factors.
Exactly. So parents are shelling out thousands of dollars for scores that are essentially meaningless in a clinical context. The company is selling the illusion of control. The conclusion drawn by the ethicists is that the real danger is not the creation of genetically engineered valids, in a Gattaca sense, but the financial waste directed toward naive, wealthy customers, and the possibility that parents might avoid implanting perfectly healthy embryos based on meaningless, unproven scores.
We've covered a remarkable range of topics in this deep dive. Let's finish strong with three rapid-fire fascinating facts from the quick take section, starting with a crucial metric popularized by wearable tech: heart rate variability, or HRV.
Right. HRV measures the minute fluctuation in the time elapsed between consecutive heartbeats. We're talking milliseconds. And counterintuitively, a high degree of variability is actually a sign of health, not irregularity.
So what does high HRV signal about the body?
It reflects the balance between the sympathetic fight-or-flight nervous system and the parasympathetic rest-and-digest system. High HRV signals a balanced autonomic nervous system and faster recovery from stressors, indicating good cardiovascular fitness.
And conversely, low HRV means what?
Low HRV means the body is kind of locked in a constant fight-or-flight state due to stress, anxiety, or inadequate sleep. It's also linked to a higher risk of death post-heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
Wearable tech like the Oura Ring has really popularized this metric, prompting people to understand their internal state better.
Is there an ideal number everyone should aim for?
Not really. A normal range is individual, typically 20 to 70 milliseconds, and it generally declines with age. The key is tracking your personal relative change over time. If your HRV suddenly drops below your established baseline, it signals physical stress, a warning sign to prioritize vigorous exercise, better sleep, or hydration.
Next, let's look at resources, rare earth elements. The name suggests scarcity, but the source material says that's a profound misnomer.
It is a critical misnomer. The 17 elements, mostly lanthanides plus scandium and yttrium, are actually quite abundant in the crust, often more so than precious metals like gold.
So the rare part refers to how hard they are to get.
Exactly. They're difficult, resource intensive, and environmentally damaging to extract because they are typically found in low concentrations alongside other elements. Current mining methods are energy intensive and produce vast amounts of acidic, radioactive waste and toxic dust.
And we need them for everything.
Pretty much all modern tech. Smartphones, EVs, wind turbines, medical devices. At current production rates, the magazine warns, we will run out of known global reserves, 90.9 million metric tons, in 60 to 100 years.
So we need better recycling.
And cleaner, more efficient extraction methods, absolutely.
Finally, let's wrap up with a counterintuitive economic insight from auction theory, the Nobel-winning work of William Vickrey.
Vickrey's Nobel Prize was awarded for his analysis of the psychological strategies inherent in different auction types. He highlighted the difference between the standard first-price sealed bid auction and his ingenious alternative, the second-price sealed bid auction, now called a Vickrey auction.
And in the standard first price option, you try to shade your bid, offering less than your true maximum value to avoid overpaying, which makes it a game of strategic guessing.
Exactly. But in the Vickrey auction, where the highest bidder wins but only pays the second highest bid, the strategy changes completely. Vickrey proved that the optimal strategy is to bid your true, honest valuation for the item.
Why is that the optimal strategy?
Because if you win, you pay no more than the second highest bid, securing the item at a price you are willing to pay anyway. If you underbid and lose to someone who valued the item less than you did, you miss out on a deal you would have gladly taken. The mechanics force honesty to become the best policy.
And this work led to the surprising revenue equivalence theorem.
It did. The theorem states that under idealized conditions, all four main auction types, Vickrey, first price sealed bid, English, and Dutch, actually yield the exact same expected revenue for the seller.
But they're used differently in practice.
Their practical application differs wildly. For instance, Dutch auctions are used for perishable items like flowers because they resolve quickly, while English auctions are better for items like art because the open, incremental bidding reveals information and encourages competition.
What a sweep of material. From the tiny electrical sparks that may have created early life to the massive logistical hurdles facing a Mars mission, this issue of Scientific American presents an inescapable tension.
It's the overwhelming dichotomy of human ingenuity confronting political self-sabotage. we see the staggering speed of scientific progress, personalized cancer vaccines, and rapid PPD drugs versus the inertia and policy roadblocks actively holding it back.
Whether it's political cuts to mRNA funding, the cancellation of the MSR, or powerful lobbying against plastic reduction.
It's that man with the stick in his bike spokes, again and again.
A tough image to shake. And as we finish this deep dive, let's leave you, the listener, with one final provocative thought that connects our extraterrestrial explorations.
We detailed how the search for evidence of life on Enceladus hinges on finding those complex organic intermediates, the pyrimidines and lipids needed for cell structures. We also discussed how the hunt for Martian life evidence is stalled by funding, potentially leaving samples stranded.
Right.
So think about this. If we confirm that all the right chemical ingredients and perfect environmental conditions, water, energy, and precursors are present on both Mars and Enceladus, two different bodies in two different ways, and yet after exhaustive searching we find no life, what does that imply about the rarity or perhaps the necessity of that final spark that transforms mere chemistry into biology?
A question that might just reshape our place in the universe. Thank you for guiding us through this challenging but critical deep dive.
Thank you.